This show is brought to you by 13 Turns, a new horror anthology by Kevin Carr. 13 jolting tales of terror, murder, and the macabre. Only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, Scotch Potatoes, across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today's movies are going to be Fantastic Four, Shaun of the Sheep of the Dead, no, just Shaun of the Sheep, The Gift, Ricky and the Flash, which is not part of the DC Cinematic Universe, and Irrational Man. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, some box office predictions, and of course, the world-famous DVD Roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the interwebs at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. That also works as my Instagram handle, fatguysatthemovies, if you want to see some of the stupid things I post picture-wise. And you can reach me on Twitter at twitter.com/kevincarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Thanks, Ron Burgundy. This is another relatively slow news week. Minor development news. Nothing groundbreaking. You know, not like when they announced Ben Affleck was going to be playing Batman a couple years ago. I talked about last week that Channing Tatum has rumored to have dropped out of the Gambit movie, which, of course, would have been a disaster because nobody cares about Gambit except Gambit fans. And Channing Tatum is a big movie star that could actually bring an audience to the movie. Turns out he has officially signed for it. So this is one of the reasons why I hate covering developmental news, because everything turns on a dime. Oh, he's in it. He's not. He is. And I mean, I was figuring he was in it since he took a big production picture around San Diego Comic-Con as part of this Fox Studios version of their own Marvel Cinematic Universe. What people forget, and this dovetails into one of the trailers I'm going to talk about today, we still haven't gotten anybody's extended universe except Marvel. And by Marvel, I mean Marvel Studios, the people who did the Avengers. Everyone else has plans. DC Cinematic Universe, they haven't even released their second movie in their own franchise. People forget, Man of Steel exists in a different universe than the Dark Knight series. So this Batman's going to be a different Batman. So while it has worked for Marvel Studios, there is no guarantee it's going to work for anybody else. There's no guarantee that the Fox Cinematic Marvel Universe is going to work. I mean, this weekend we've got Fantastic Four out there. Rumor is it's not going to do terribly well. So we have yet to see if any of this experiment is going to work anywhere else other than Marvel Studios. And everyone's trying to do beginning stories. And this is nothing new, because they did Batman Begins 10 years ago. There's a new Robin Hood movie that's being developed, Robin Hood Origins. Now, of course, they seem to have forgotten that Ridley Scott's Robin Hood movie was exactly that. It was how Robin Hood became Robin Hood, and there's only this little stinger at the end where he was actually doing the Robin Hood thing. There's also a BBC television series several years ago that covered sort of the young Robin Hood. So the idea of having another Robin Hood series, it reminds me of the fact that the other thing that was announced this week was that Nightmare on Elm Street's getting a reboot again. Because the 2010 reboot was so bad. The reality is these remakes don't always do well. Remakes are very popular, but remakes are not guaranteed to make money. Look at RoboCop. RoboCop was a remake, and that thing was kind of a bust. A lot of people didn't like it. It didn't do very well. Total Recall, same thing. They remade Total Recall a couple of years ago. That was a bust. This just goes to the core of Hollywood always trying to mine itself. Hollywood is really conflicted, because on one hand, they want something new and original and different that no one has ever done before, but they also want something that's a proven entity, because they're terrified to take risks. And at this point now, I mean, look at Gambit. We talked about last week. It has a $150 million budget. This is not the kind of money you gamble stuff on. Speaking of reboots, Dungeons & Dragons is getting a reboot. Warner Brothers is developing that. Hopefully it's better than Dungeons & Dragons 2, which was really terrible. The first one was goofy, childish nonsense, but the second one was really awful. Marlon Wayans was in it. A lot of people forget that. Speaking of bringing back old properties that shouldn't be brought back, Bad Boys 3 is apparently got a release date, February 17th, 2017, through Sony, which doesn't mean a whole lot, because Sony has been struggling desperately to try and do something of note lately. They are what Universal was 5-6 years ago, when Universal was making just a couple hundred million dollars for the entire year. Sony's still struggling from the hack and some bad things that have happened, but Bad Boys 3, February 17th, they don't even know who's going to direct that. They're talking about Joe Carnahan, but we don't even know if Will Smith's going to be there. Martin Lawrence will be there because he has no job right now. He's waiting for Bad Boys. He desperately wants Bad Boys anything to happen. But then they announced the release date of Bad Boys 4, July 3rd, 2019. We'll see how long that lasts until Marvel decides to drop something on that weekend. Will Smith may not even be back. We'll see what happens. But, I mean, 2019, that's 16 or 17 years since the last Bad Boys movie. I mean, Will Smith still has it as a movie star and as an actor, but that's a long time. And then finally, in development news, which I find somewhat silly, Sony is also making a Barbie movie written by Diablo Cody, which sounds like a punchline to a bad joke instead of actual real development news. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Let's talk about Deadpool, since we're talking about the Fox cinematic universe for Marvel. Deadpool, which opens on February 12th, Valentine's Day, finally got its trailer, a Red Band trailer, famously Red Band trailer. We're going to play the safe versions of that right now.
We can fight this.
You're right. The cancer's only my liver, lungs, prostate, and brain. All things I can live without.
What if I told you we can make you better? Make you a superhero.
And please don't make the super suit green or animated.
Wait! You may be wondering why the red suit. Well, that's so bad guys can't see me bleed. This guy's got the right idea. He wore the brown pants.
Here's my prediction with Deadpool. I've never read the comics. I'm not familiar with Deadpool as a character. But from what I hear, this is relatively accurate to how Deadpool is in the comics. This is very accurate to his character. Punchy, violent, snarky, sometimes mean-spirited, in a good guy sort of way. But here's my prediction of what's going to happen with Deadpool. It's definitely going to be rated R. They're definitely pushing it as an R-rated movie. And yeah, every now and then we get movies like Kingsman did very well as an R-rated movie. That was arguably pop superhero-ish. But I don't think Deadpool's going to do well. Oddly enough, Valentine's Day is a great time to release an R-rated movie. But I just don't think Deadpool's going to do well. I don't think it's going to connect with an audience. I think you're going to get too many parents are going to take their kids because they're too stupid to actually watch the trailers or look at the fact that it's an R-rated movie and realize why it's rated R. But I think it's just the general audience is not going to know how to handle it because so many superhero movies are PG-13 and they're not going to understand what that... And then on top of it all, nobody knows who Deadpool is. And then finally, it's Ryan Reynolds. And Ryan Reynolds isn't a movie star. He's a movie star, but he doesn't bring money in. Nobody sees movies for Ryan Reynolds. He just happens to be in a couple movies that did well. Oh, probably his best performing movie, as a star, was The Proposal with Sandra Bullock, and she's the reason it did so well. So Deadpool, I don't think it's going to do well. It's going to be like Dread, which was a fun movie, but it just didn't do well. And regardless of what everyone says that it made money on video, it's not worthy of a sequel from a financial perspective because it made like $5 million. The next trailer is also opening on Valentine's Day weekend, Zoolander 2.
If God exists, then why did he make ugly people? 200 Lander?
No, Derek, 2 Lander. It's like a pun.
But I don't spell my name with a 2.
Fine. How about...
Zoolander II?
No, Zoolander 2, but with Roman numerals.
But I'm not Italian.
Jesus. You are so freaking stupid. It's insane.
This one looks funny. It's a neat little teaser trailer. And what's neat about it is it does play off a lot of the jokes from the first movie. My only nervousness about this is it's been like 15 years since Zoolander came out. And while Derek Zoolander is still a funny character, is it going to rely too much on goofing on what the first movie was? There was a certain freshness to Zoolander. I always get nervous when you let 15 years lapse between movies and they kind of become legends due to home video viewing. Still could be very funny. It's just a teaser, but it's exactly what a teaser should be. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to start reviewing movies with Fantastic Four and Ricky and the Flash. Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Let's hit some movie reviews. Let's talk about Fantastic Four. This is a reboot of the Fantastic Four series that actually was done about 10 years ago by Tim Story and Fox. It's a Marvel movie, but even though, and then a lot of people don't get into the studios and who does what, but it's significant to note that this is Fox, the people who do the X-Men, not Disney and Marvel Studios, which are the people who do the Avengers. So there is a bit of a split here. So you're not going to see a Iron Man or Thor crossover with the Fantastic Four. You may not see anything after this movie because the movie is getting some pretty terrible reviews, but let's hear what my take is on it. The original first family of Marvel Comics gets a gritty reboot about four scientists who are given superpowers.
Dr. Storm, we gave you 6 years and millions of dollars, and you gave us nothing. What's different now?
Reed Richards. He knows answers to questions we don't even know to ask yet. They just cracked interdimensional travel.
Four have survived. All exhibit unique physical conditions.
I just want to fix my friends.
You can't fix this.
Now, this movie is different than pretty much any iteration of Fantastic Four that you've ever seen in the screen, because it strips away all the comedy and all the lightheartedness of it. And that kind of is a staple to it. That's classic Stan Lee storytelling. That's old-fashioned Marvel, in my opinion, the whimsical, lighthearted element that you have in the Fantastic Four movies. This has none of that. There are bits in the script that feel like it should be a joke, but that it doesn't play as a joke because it's so gritty and so dark. It's very dark. But that's not the biggest problem with this movie. The biggest problem with this movie is it doesn't know what it's trying to do. It has this origin story, which goes for about the first half or so, maybe a little bit more. I'm so tired of origin stories, especially ones that if we've had a movie in the last 10 years with these characters, we don't need an origin story. We know who they are. But they go back and retread this origin story, which at least is different. It wasn't like Spider-Man, where they just literally reshot the first movie in order to give you an origin story again of the Amazing Spider-Man. But this one changes a little bit, but there's no conflict. And while the actors are actually okay in their roles, I mean, Miles Teller's okay as Reed Richards, Johnny Storm by Michael B. Jordan is probably the best one there, and Jamie Bell, who does Ben Grimm, who's the Thing. Kate Mara is awful as the Invisible Woman. She is terrible. I mean, she doesn't have chemistry with anybody on set. She just sort of looks there like a deer in the headlights. And once it gets to the origin story, it turns into like a sequel of itself where it's trying to resolve things. It jumps ahead, and it's clear that this thing was tinkered with a lot, even to the point that Josh Trank, the director, came out and badmouthed his own movie on Thursday on Twitter, which I think is interesting because usually filmmakers wait a couple of years for the movie to bomb before they start making fun of it, which I think is a cheap thing to do. You know, if you did the movie, you did the movie. And if you couldn't get along with a studio to produce and direct and make a movie that people are going to like, that's your fault too. So apparently Josh Trank had some behind the scenes problems with this one, and it's not the movie he wanted to make. But you know what? You signed on for a Marvel movie. You signed on for a big superhero epic movie with probably a pretty huge budget. You shouldn't be a pain in the butt. It's sort of like when David Fincher did the third Alien movie. There's all these stories about how he fought with the studio and he didn't do that. Well, it was an Alien movie. This was not some little rinky-dink science fiction movie that they made for $10 million. It was a major release. And of course, Fox is going to get their fingers in there. But anyways, this movie has no charm to it. It has no heart and soul. It's just the people going through the motions. I there are parts of it that are really cool and the effects are cool, but you know, there's very little superhero action. And when they finally do the superhero action, which is kind of cool for what it is, it doesn't fit with the rest of the movie. So ultimately, Fantastic Four is a bit of a dud and doesn't quite work. Not a great movie. I mean, I like the first ones, even though a lot of people didn't, but at least they sort of felt like the original comic books. This doesn't at all. This just feels like it's trying too hard. So Fantastic Four kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Ricky and the Flash. Even though that sounds like it's a movie with the Flash in it, the Flash is a band. It is not the superhero from the CW. Meryl Streep plays a musician who comes back to her neglected family to reconnect with her daughter.
Hello?
I've been trying to call you. It's Julie, our daughter. Max left her.
What?
Whoa, Mom, you're here. It's like the 80s all over again.
Hope Maureen doesn't mind that I'm here.
Oh, hi.
We are really concerned about Julie.
What happened?
Max came home, told me that he was in love with a girl named Nicole.
She's going to be all right. She's always been a fighter.
Well, she's had to be.
I am not a huge Meryl Streep fan. I respect the heck out of the woman, and I've seen movies that she's done that she's very, very good in, like The Devil Wears Prada or something like that, or even Into the Woods. She chewed the scenery in that, but she really gave her all in that film. But I am not a big fan of movies that are spotlighted on her. This is sort of like Dustin Hoffman. Dustin Hoffman's good when you direct him, but when you put him in a movie and then just make it all about him, he just kind of sucks in the movie. And Meryl Streep, I know it's sacrilege to say, but she annoys the heck out of me in this movie. Plus, half the movie is them singing, and I didn't go to watch Meryl Streep's cover band. I went to go, well, I had to go see it because I had to work, but the biggest problem with this movie, it's written by Diablo Cody, and it's not the biggest problem that it's written by Diablo Cody, but this is very inherent in her work. I haven't seen anything of Diablo Cody's I've liked since Juno, where she deservedly won the Academy Award, but other things like Paradise and other movies that she's written, like Young Adult, I've just disliked. And the reason is because the characters are awful. And I've said this before about movies like Trainwreck, which actually, Meryl Streep in this movie is a bigger train wreck than, not bigger, but almost as big of a train wreck as Amy Schumer's character is in Trainwreck itself. But I didn't like the people. I didn't like the characters. They're just so acerbic, awful, stupid pieces, shreds of humanity. Then Diablo Cody does these weird things where she's trying to, I guess, be different. So, of course, there's this band that's out there playing in Tarzana, California. But apparently they're all conservatives. And I'm like, that's usually not where you go. And then they go to Indianapolis, where everybody's sort of like this wacky, hippy-dippy liberal. And I'm like, I live about 3 hours from Indianapolis. Indianapolis is very Midwestern, and I wouldn't exactly call it hippy-dippy liberal. I guess she was trying to do something different and playing against convention, but just doing something different doesn't play against convention. You have to have a reason for it. This movie bored the heck out of me, and it is so done as a love letter to Meryl Streep that she can do no wrong, and she is the highlight and the focus of this film. It was just boring. It was boring, and I hated the characters. I wanted to set them on fire throughout the film, and I couldn't wait to get out of there. But again, it has some great people involved. I mean, Meryl Streep, obviously a good actress. You have Kevin Kline in there. You've got it directed by Jonathan Demme. This guy won an Oscar for Silence of the Lambs. But I would rather spend a weekend with Hannibal Lecter than I would with Ricky and the Flash or her awful family. So while I can understand the desire to put something out there that is a dysfunctional family movie, and while I can enjoy a dysfunctional family movie at times, there's got to be something likable about them. But these characters are awful, and their redemption is so ersatz and so false and so just fantasy written. It doesn't have an inkling of truth in it at all. And the only people I think that are going to like this are people who are diehard Meryl Streep fans. And if you are, great, good for you. You like Meryl Streep. That's awesome. I'm not a huge fan of hers. And that's why I'm going to have to say Ricky and the Flash totally sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Shaun the Sheep and The Gift. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kuykendall Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
I'm too sexy for my shirt, too sexy for my shirt, so sexy it hurts.
Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies. Continuing the movie reviews, let's go and have some fun with this one. Shaun the Sheep. Aardman Animation brings their TV show to the big screen, in which Shaun and his flock have to travel to the big city to save their farmer from amnesia.
Shaun the Sheep and his flock know every trick to having a good time. But things can get out of control very quickly. Now, to get the family back together, they'll need a little wool power and a lot of teamwork.
Anyone knows me, they know me. I love animation. I almost every year, at least one to two or sometimes three animated films make my top 10 list of best films of the year. I adore animation. I love Pixar. One of my favorite animation companies is Laika, who does stuff. They recently did the Box Trolls, and they did Coraline and Paranorman. I love that stop motion animation too. And you still get that with Laika, but also with Aardman. And there's only been one Aardman movie I really haven't liked, and I need to go back and revisit it. And that's Flushed Away. I was not a fan of that when it came out, but I thought Chicken Run was really cute. I loved Wallace and Gromit. These are cool little movies. Just for the artistry of the animation, it being stop motion, because so much is CGI animation, and I get that, and I'm not downgrading CGI, I'm just saying that it's neat to see old school animation again. Shaun the Sheep is extremely British. Now, I have a huge appreciation for British humor and British delivery and British entertainment. And a lot of this comes from the fact that when I was a kid, we had four TV channels, because we didn't have cable. We had ABC, CBS, and NBC. And then we had PBS. And PBS, at the very least, it offered something different, because the other three stations in the morning, there was news, and then there was game shows, and there was news, and then there were soap operas, and then there was syndicated programming, and then there was prime time. It was the exact same. No matter what station you were on, you got the same kind of programming. And so I ended up watching a lot of PBS when I was younger, because at least it was different. Yeah, there's a lot of educational programming on PBS, but really they imported a lot of British shows. Now, you don't need that now, because now you can watch BBC America, and you can get stuff on Netflix that were just not available for us. But I remember watching, and it's not all esoteric educational stuff. There's stuff like Monty Python, which isn't exactly educational. It's very funny, though. And I grew up watching British comedy, and so I love the British comedy and the British delivery. And I show my kids, we watch Doctor Who, and we watch the IT Crowd, and I was watching Blackadder with my son a couple weeks ago. We like British shows. So I, of course, adored Shaun the Sheep, because it's very British, and it's very European in its delivery. It doesn't spoon feed you its jokes. There's a lot of subtlety to it. There's a lot of subtlety in the background. There's humor and jokes, Easter eggs tucked away in the set. And that's not saying that it's all highbrow. There's burping and farting in this movie too. So nothing wrong with that. But there's a certain level of absurdity that you get with British programming that you don't get with mainstream American programming. So I fear Shaun the Sheep's going to have a little bit of a struggle in the box office, because it's not an overt spoon-fed comedy. But it's very, very funny. And one of the things that I think shows its hand as being European or British is there's no dialogue in this movie. I mean, there's people talking and sheep's talking, but they don't speak English. Everyone talks like, and that's how everybody sounds. It's a trick you see in animation a lot. If you watch enough animation, especially short film stuff, there's a lot of animation that doesn't use dialogue, but putting it into a long-form feature-length film can be very daunting, to the point that I remember when they made a Tom and Jerry animated film, oh gosh, 20, 25 years ago, they had to make them talk. which ruins it. I mean, Tom and Jerry is a great example of cartoons that very mainstream American that had no dialogue in it. And I don't think there's anybody who has trouble understanding Tom and Jerry. Pink Panther cartoons, same thing. There's no dialogue in a Pink Panther cartoon. It's easy to do that for 7 to 10 minutes. It's a little more difficult to do it for a feature-length film. But it works like crazy. And it's really charming and adorable and fun and exciting. And it moves. It has an energy. And it's definitely worth checking out. And it's great for kids and great for adults. So, yeah, Aardman Animation, if you like stuff like Chicken Run or Wallace and Gromit, it's the same kind of humor, same kind of delivery, and same kind of character design. Absolutely worth seeing. Shaun the Sheep totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is The Gift. A socially awkward man tries to befriend an old high school classmate, overstepping polite boundaries and possibly becoming dangerous.
Welcome home, smiley face Gordo.
How do you think he got our address?
That guy's odd.
He's a little socially awkward, but I can be like that. Gordo, hi.
All right, after high school, and some people stay exactly the same.
Thank you.
He's delusional and thinks that we're friends. Don't visit us anymore.
It's not over.
Simon, after all these years, I was willing to let bygones be bygones.
What does that mean?
I do not know.
Before I actually talk about the movie and the story and the characters, let's talk about the production. Joel Edgerton, who stars in this, and he's been in everything. He was in Star Wars Episode II as a young Owen Lars. He's also was in movies like Warrior, and he was in The Great Gatsby. He's a well-known actor. But he directed and wrote this as well. He plays Gordo, who's the weird, creepy guy who is sort of imposing himself on this couple, played by Jason Bateman and Rebecca Hall. He directed and wrote this, which is an accomplishment simply because a lot of times when an actor directs something, it's one of two things. It's either terrible or they're basically directing in name only. I heard, I don't know if this is true, but I heard that that's kind of what happened with Unbroken and Angelina Jolie, that she directed it, sure, but it was really kind of directed by committee because she's an actor, she's not a director. It seems like Joel Edgerton did a good job with this one, and I'm curious to see more of what he does, especially since this fits in a low-budget thriller. What this reminds me of is the sort of stalker/home invasion kind of thrillers we got a lot of in the 90s. Stuff like Sleeping with the Enemy. There's a whole bit in Sleeping with the Enemy where who straightened the towels? And that's how she knew that her husband, who was coming after her, was in the house. Ah, he straightened the towels. You get stuff like that thrown in this movie. It almost feels a little bit out of sync with what you normally see today, which is cool because home invasion thrillers and sort of stalking thrillers today have a very different, more violent, almost torture pornish feel at times. You even go, this is several years ago, but something like The Strangers. These kind of movies that blur the line between horror and thriller. This is very much a thriller, and I'm not going to use the term Hitchcockian, because first of all, it's not as good as Hitchcock or anything like that, but you can tell he's going for suspense, he's not going for jump scares or violence, and that's actually really good, and that's, I think, what makes the movie work. And there's other secrets involved. It's not just a straightforward, hey, this guy's a bad guy coming after you. There's a little bit more going on behind the scenes, which is good, because it blurs the lines and it grays up the characters a bit, which makes it work. So yeah, The Gift is, it's well acted. It also, what's neat about it too, Rebecca Hall's fine, and I'm not a huge fan of hers, but Jason Bateman I'm a big fan of. I like his stuff. And he's so well known for comedies. And he's usually the straight man delivering very acerbic dialogue. That's kind of where he's he shines as the straight man or as somebody who is surprisingly mean. Like in his movie Bad Words, where he's really kind of an awful person. But he's very smiley, and that's where the comedy's mined from. There's no comedy in this. And Jason Bateman, he plays a very dark version of characters he's played before, but I like it. I'd like to see Jason Bateman do more stuff. I'd like to see him as a villain. I'd like to see him do something like, if you remember the film Pacific Heights, which came out in the early 90s, which feels like this kind of a movie where, you know, it's a home thriller. That one had Michael Keaton as the bad guy, and it was right after he did Batman. And it showed that he actually is a better villain than he was a hero. And I'd love to see Jason Bateman as the overt villain sometimes, because I think he's got a darkness there. Not just the smarmy salesman type, but like an evil person. Got a lot of good performances and layers in the performances that I really kind of like. So I'm going to have to say that The Gift kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I'm going to come back and review another film and also do the box office and the DVD roundup. Elizabeth Stokes' new romance novel, Five Nights in Vegas, is about meeting, getting married, and falling in love, in that order. Lexi Frost is a cocktail waitress in a Las Vegas casino. Nate Zimmerman is a marketing executive from back east. After a chance meeting on Nate's business trip, they wake up to discover they got married at an all-night wedding chapel. During their whirlwind attempt to undo their mistake, Lexi and Nate discover they might just be made for each other after all. Five Nights in Vegas by Elizabeth Stokes is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Kevin Carr with Fat Guys at the Movies, continuing ahead. Before we move on to the nitty-gritty of the box office and DVDs, let's talk about another movie that's out. Irrational Man, written and directed by Woody Allen. And it's a story about a philosophy professor who finds new meaning in life when he makes a decision to do something terrible.
I hear Abe Lucas is going to be joining the faculty this summer.
Really? That should put some Viagra into the philosophy department.
I haven't been able to perform in nearly a year. I can't write. I can't breathe.
I couldn't remember the reason for living.
The dizziness and anxiety had disappeared, and I was happy and enjoying the joy of living.
I'm Abe Lucas. I've had many experiences, and now a unique one.
This was the meaningful act I was searching for.
Woody Allen is at times his own worst enemy. I'm not even talking about his private life, although that's true. His movies suffer from being too Woody Allen-ish. Woody Allen can never rise out of his completely neurotic, overbearing intellectualism. Now, recently, one of his problems is that his films have become travelogues. He had movies that did very well that were claimed. Stuff like Match Point, which was brilliant. And Scoop also was done in London. They showcased London and they showcased Europe. And he was basically spending time in Europe. And then he did Vicky Cristina Barcelona. And of course, it was showing how lovely Barcelona was. And although it was a well-received movie, it still became a bit of a travelogue for Barcelona. Probably, too, the greatest extreme was Midnight in Paris. I've talked to multiple people who are just like, well, I love Paris so much that I couldn't help but fall in love with that movie. And then he did the movie From Rome with Love, which you're just like, oh, okay, good Lord, Woody Allen, we get it. You love Europe. Just quit going on vacation. He was basically making his Woody Allen versions of Adam Sandler movies where he's using his movies as an excuse to go to these wonderful cities. Then he did Magic in the Moonlight last year, which was, I think, the south of France. And again, it was all about the backdrop and the locations. At some point, let's just step back and do something different, do something new. Incidentally, he used to do that in the 70s and 80s with his movies are all about New York and Manhattan. He made a movie called Manhattan about Manhattan. So he has this love letter to New York in his movies. This one at least is not just a travelogue of Europe, which I thought was interesting. Where it has its problems is there's a romance between Emma Stone and Joaquin Phoenix, who plays the professor. And he's much older. And that inappropriately aged romance is such a staple of Woody Allen movie. And it mirrors his life. I mean, let's face it. This is a guy who has always found sexual inspiration outside of what should be his comfort zone. And as he's gotten older, it's just getting creepier and creepier. The problem is the romance is unnecessary. This whole attraction between Emma Stone and Joaquin Phoenix is completely not necessary to tell the story that it's telling, because it's not at all about her. Yeah, she's sort of the audience surrogate, you know, how you experience this. And then it's not that you can remove her character completely, but you don't need that relationship. You just need to have somebody there. It could have been anybody at any age. It's just a little creepy the way they do it. He also needs to stop having people say, "I must say," because there's a scene in the movie where I think within 10 minutes, three people say, "I must say that this is the greatest thing I've ever done." No one says that except Ed Grimley. It shows overly narrow writing by Woody Allen. And I think he's getting a little old and some people aren't you know, he just doesn't have people who can trust him and say, yeah, that's not a very natural thing to say. But once you get past all that, sort of the crux of the movie is this very dark and dangerous thing that Joaquin Phoenix's character is doing. So, I mean, it's a matter of life and death type stuff. So that's really interesting. And it takes a while to get there. But when that happens, it's a very interesting movie and it has a lot to say. And being a philosophy professor, he is able to bring in, you know, some greater issues of, you know, moral relativism and some deeper philosophical ideas to that. But on the whole, it really works. Once it gets to that part, it's not as good as Match Point, because Match Point does that too. Match Point starts off as just sort of this insipid story about these people you don't really care about. And then it gets this real dark turn to it. And that's when it becomes really interesting. And that's what made Match Point such a good movie from Woody Allen, which was kind of his return to greatness. This one isn't as good as Match Point, but it reminds me of that, where the last couple movies he's done have been somewhat shallow in terms of depth of thought and fluffy, we'll say. I mean, Magic in the Moonlight was absolute fluff. And yeah, Blue Jasmine was a little heavier, but this one shows that he can tap into some interesting ideas still at his age. So I'm going to have to say that overall, I thought Irrational Man, while it was imperfect and takes a while to get going, still kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the box office. Last week, I predicted $70 million for Mission Impossible. Did not quite hit that. It was only at about 55 and change, which is still good. That's actually a very good opening. People are so used to these massive $100 million plus openings. You had Guardians of the Galaxy make almost $100 million over the weekend last year at this same weekend, and you had Jurassic World make $200 million. Over its opening weekend. So people poo-poo a $55 million weekend, but that's still pretty doggone good. And that's on par. And in fact, an improvement on some of the Mission Impossible movies. Now, granted, you've got IMAX and some inflation to deal with too, but it's still good. I think the good word of mouth helped this movie. And they moved, it was moved. I think it was originally supposed to come out later in the year at Christmas, but they bumped it here, which was a smart move because it was really only going up against Vacation. And Vacation did not do well. It made just under $15 million. That was just for the weekend. If you go by its entire five-day run, it said $21 million. I actually said it was going to struggle to make $20 million over that 5 days. That's not very good. Now, the thing that is going to save Vacation is it wasn't an expensive movie to make. I mean, Mission Impossible was very expensive. Mission Impossible was not a cheap film. One thing that's interesting about Mission Impossible is we'll see how well it does in China. In the long run, it's co-financed by a Chinese company. And I saw that in another movie. I think it was The Gift this week. Has an overtly Chinese company. It's not just some obscurely named company. It's like China Distribution Company or something like that, that helped produce Mission Impossible. And this other one, it had Chinese characters. So it's clearly a Chinese enterprise that helped do these movies, which of course means they're going to get better play overseas. And China's a huge market. Not as big as the U.S. yet, but it's getting there. It's people do not ignore the Chinese market when they make movies now. Vacation's not going to do well in China. I don't expect to see another Vacation movie. And this is the core. I said this last week about Vacation being the people were unappealing. And that's what I didn't like. And I said this on the radio in an interview, and finally the light bulb went on over my head. I realized when they had the original Griswolds, several years later, they do Christmas Vacation where they all stay at home and then the insanity comes to them. And it works as a good Christmas movie. And it's arguably just as good, if not better, than the original Vacation. This Vacation movie, could you imagine these people doing a Christmas Vacation in a couple of years? You'd want to kill yourself. This would not make a good movie. That's the core of why the movie's not good. Actually, I think Fantastic Four is going to struggle this weekend. Some really bad reviews. The fact that they embargoed the reviews and didn't screen it very much. And it's getting terrible reviews. I think it's going to suffer. And I think it's going to actually lose to Mission Impossible. I think Mission Impossible is going to win the weekend with $35 million. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll in the world-famous DVD roundup. First off is a movie that came out last week, and that's because the Disney Channel played the movie The Descendants on Friday, last Friday, and so that's when the DVD then came out. This is sort of like the Disney Channel version of Once Upon a Time, where they bring all of these Disney animated film stories and they all kind of exist in the same universe, even though they really don't when you see the movies. And this is about all the villains have gotten booted off the mainland and sent them to an island. And they're sort of, it's sort of like Australia. And the prince says, hey, it's been long enough. Let's have the children of the bad guys come and be here. It'll be an outreach program, which is actually the right thing to do, by the way. It's cute enough. It's directed by Kenny Ortega. It's not meant to be. I think they were hoping it would be the next High School Musical, which Kenny Ortega did. And who knows? It might be. It might get some more play because it took a little bit of time for High School Musical to ramp up before Disney realized, like, wow, this is a phenomenon. We'll see. This sort of cross-pollination of storybook characters is very popular. It's cute enough. It has some decent production numbers. It doesn't hold together as well, and it has some corniness, but it's Disney Channel. What do you expect? There's also Insurgent, which I did not like. That is out on DVD this week, and I just think that series is falling apart. True Story is also out. That one stars Jonah Hill as a reporter interviewing James Franco, whose character had been allegedly a murderer and killed his whole family, and he's sort of trying to discern whether or not he actually did the deed. There's also How to Get Away with Murder Season 1, ironically, also coming out the week that True Story is. This one stars Viola Davis as a law professor who is working with her students to uncover the real killer in a years-old real murder mystery. So Season 1 is available. You can check that out before it comes back on ABC this fall. And then finally, The Nightmare. I talked about this one a couple weeks ago. This is the documentary about sleep paralysis. Very interesting, a little bit hogwash, but then again, it's by the people who did Room 237, so you kind of expect that sort of thing. That's it. I need to go for the week. Next week, I'm going to be talking about The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and Straight Outta Compton. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.